This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
The young shining cuckoo is fed by its foster parents on insects and spiders. But the korimako, or bellbird, has a much more interesting diet of nectar. It's been something of a radio personality and has sung on shortwave radio to Australia and the Pacific nations for 30 years. However, the early recordings failed to reflect the versatility of the bellbird, with its wide variety of liquid notes and artistically placed clicks and bell-like sounds. It's not surprising that Maori mythology describes korimako, the bellbird, as the messenger of tane, sent to herald the coming of the sun.
Community or chaos, we can construct and nurture community or fall into chaos. Over the next hour, Marvin Hubbard hosts conversations toward creating a fairer, more equal society.
Community or Chaos is made possible with the support of Quakers Aotearoa. You'll find them online at quaker.org.nz.
Good morning, friends. Today we'll be talking with Jill Brown, who is the Principal Housing Advisor for the Dunedin City Council. And we'll be talking about homelessness with Gail, a crisis, actually, of homelessness in Dunedin and in New Zealand. Well, welcome to Community or Chaos, Jill.
Karen, thank you for having me.
What got you interested in housing and homelessness?
I guess all of my career I've worked with people, and I've always been looking out for the little guy. I worked for a significant amount of my career as a rehab worker in corrections, so saw a whole lot of people who were exiting out of corrections or sometimes not even being able to get out of corrections because they didn't have anywhere to go. I then went on to Kāinga Ora, or Housing New Zealand as it was at that point, and got to know the social housing industry quite well, and then realised that there needed to be some really quite large systemic changes happen, and that I got an opportunity to do that at the council. So here I am.
Well, can you tell us a bit about working for Kāinga Ora State Housing and what changes did you see needed to happen? Because up until the 70s or even the early 80s, they were fairly successful. You didn't see people sleeping in the streets in the 70s. I mean, they had problems. They had different styles of living, and perhaps not every culture was catered for. But what were your main considerations you'd like to see changed?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at New Zealand's building history, up until the mid to late 70s, we were building to abundance, which basically meant that house prices were lower. And it meant that people who were on what we would consider today to be fairly ordinary wages could afford to have one parent working and the other parent at home. That changed when we stopped building to abundance. When I went to Housing New Zealand, we were in that transition period from Housing New Zealand to Kāinga Ora. And it was actually very exciting because there was huge numbers of builds being progressed. And although Dunedin didn't get all of the builds that were on the cards, we at least got some.
What years was that? Was it in the 90s or 80s?
No, this was just recently. So okay. I went into Kāinga Ora about 6 or 7 years ago.
But the homelessness started happening, increasing quite a bit back in the 90s.
Absolutely.
And that housing abundance was probably good for the common person. I remember I was working for the post office at a time. My family was helped into our first house, and that wouldn't happen now. So it seems to me that homelessness is political as much as economic.
Yeah, I think you're correct there. We opened up the building of homes rather than looking at it as a human right. We changed to make it a commodity, and now our you know, a huge portion of our economic driver is based on capital gains and property ownership.
Isn't this a failure both for the housing for homeless people and for people who want to buy, live in a home, and for the economy itself? I mean, instead of, you know, investing in energy or investing in making things in New Zealand or adding value, we just invest in housing and hope that the price of housing goes up.
Yeah, and it's a very passive investment. You know, we don't, there's no productivity that comes out of it necessarily if we buy a home that's already built.
And there's no good that comes out of it either.
Maybe so, yeah.
I mean, it's good for people that end up owning half a dozen or more houses, but maybe that shouldn't be the goal of housing in New Zealand.
I mean, I think fundamentally now, with the visibility of homelessness being far more in the general public's eye, I mean, it's been around for a number of years. We know that it's been around for a number of years, but it's been relatively well hidden. You know, a lot of our people...
If you worked at Food Bank or you talked to people like that, I mean, I was quite aware of it in the 90s.
Yeah, yeah. And a lot of people who work in those social sectors were, you know, people,
well,
as I said, people coming out of prison, not having a place to go, people not getting bail because they didn't have an address to go to. So we saw all that happening, but the general public weren't seeing, like they're seeing now, tents on the Oval.
Can you tell us what your job is as a housing advisor to the City Council?
Yeah, well, yeah, it's a very complicated job, because effectively what I'm trying to do, especially in the homeless sector, is to create some systemic change, and that means getting everybody that we can into the room so that we can actually do something together. Because in my belief, we have enough money across the system; we just actually have to pull it together. That is challenging. In where some of our agencies and NGOs are fighting for contracts or fighting to retain their own piece of whatever the budget looks like. So it's a challenging space. Alongside that, I also am trying to look at the levers that Dunedin City Council can pull. So do we have spaces where we've got residential land that perhaps could be built on? Do we have levers to help community housing providers build at a lower cost? Those are all questions to be asked, answered. And the other thing is I work with developers as well. You know, there's a number of great developers in Dunedin and around Otago, and working with them to get them to start thinking about how they can provide for perhaps groups that they hadn't thought of before. And an example of that would be that one of the developers that I worked with very early on hadn't actually thought too much about creating homes that have facilities to be able to become adapted for somebody with disabilities, for example. And we know as you get older, you are far more likely to become less mobile and so on. So he started amending some of his builds to incorporate that, which is fantastic for the overall number of houses we have in Dunedin.
Do I hear you say that we probably have enough money in Dunedin to not have homeless people?
Well, I mean, I think if we think about corrections pays about $1,000 a prisoner a day. If we are keeping somebody in prison without being able to give them parole, this is just one example, without being able to give them parole because they have nowhere to go, because they have no house to go to, that money mounts up pretty quickly.
At the end of August 2022, there were about 300 household groups who were on social housing waiting list. How many people are now waiting for social housing? How many more people are either homeless or are in very substandard living conditions?
Yeah, so the numbers are actually quite difficult to get, but the current register, the current social housing register, sits at 372 when I looked at it up last, and that was about 2 or 3 weeks ago. 372 could be family groups or it could be individuals. Council itself has its own wait list, and we don't know, there's a couple of hundred on that. We don't know if those people are also on the social housing register. And for our homeless and folk, the only numbers we have, the only data that we have, comes from the census.
Is that bothering you that they're cancelled the census?
Yes.
I mean, what kind of information would... It means to me, it means that people who have had addresses and cell phones, and they'll have information about them. But if you're homeless or you have to move from address to address, you could get easily lost.
Yeah, and we know that the numbers that are shown in the census, which for the Otago area are, you know, just over 4,000 people in housing, without housing or in housing distress. Some of that information can't come from anywhere else. So you may remember when you did your census forms yourself, there was information or questions around mould in your home. There's no, if you own your own home, there's no other place where that information would show up apart from the census. So we are going to lose some significant information. The issue for us with the census with regards to our homeless folk is that they probably didn't take part in it. So the numbers effectively are sort of estimated, but sort of not. So it's an incomplete number.
Would the incomplete census be better than NOSC?
Absolutely.
I mean, isn't it in some ways to the advantage of a conservative government that doesn't want to spend money on people to have no consensus, no census?
That's a very politically charged question.
Yeah, well, why do people dump the census?
Yeah, I mean,
and won't we lose a lot of information we should have as a society?
Yeah, I think we will lose a lot of information. Absolutely.
To me, homelessness is carelessness. Carelessness of government, carelessness of who we vote for, carelessness of paying taxes, especially if we can afford to pay taxes, carelessness about human need. There's something careless about society when you get large numbers of homeless people.
Yeah, I think the word for me there is care. I agree that there's a level of carelessness in policies and procedures.
But if we care, then we won't be careless.
Yeah, for me, it's about how do we care for people who are in a more difficult situation than ourselves. We have, we know that a number, about a third of the people who are homeless across the motu have significant needs in either mental health or physical health. So, you know, that speaks to other parts of our system. So homelessness is a symptom, a significant symptom of a whole lot of things that have gone wrong in our society.
What, I mean, homelessness itself may actually serve to make matters worse for people. I mean, how many schools you have to go to as a child if your family has to move quite often, maybe more than once a year, because they can't afford to pay the rent or they need to find cheaper accommodation?
Yep. Well,
what does that do for your schooling? What does that do for your social life?
Absolutely.
And what does it do for your health if you don't get proper housing?
And if you look at this, if you look at the homeless numbers and you break it down into age groups, you know, we're talking about 4,092 who are in housing stress, so either without shelter or in situations which are inappropriate, so maybe overcrowding situations, temporary accommodation, living in motels, or in uninhabitable places. We have, of that 4,000, just over 4,000, we have just over 1,000 of those are under the age of 15. So we're not only doing damage to the people who are living there as adults, we're actually already beginning to impact on the next generation. And as you say, if somebody is in housing distress or their family's in housing distress, then that means that they're not going to likely go to school as much, or they are not likely to be able to engage in social activities like sports and all of those things, which impacts long-term health.
Or even going to the same doctor.
Absolutely. Even having a doctor.
This is an old age problem, even in New Zealand. I'm reading about Harry Lee, the MP, who grew up in a homeless situation. And it affected himself and all those around him. Mm. And we thought after the Labour Party became the government and we started having housing, building housing for people, this would never happen again.
Mm-hmm.
Why did we let it happen?
Oh, that's a really big question. I think part of it is that we have become so wrapped up in our own stuff, that whole community thing is perhaps not as obvious as it used to be. I honestly don't know. I can tell you though that of the numbers of people who contact me with concerns or complaints about our homeless folk, by far the largest number is of concerns. So it shows that our community does care, but it is incredibly challenging to nail it down to sort of one cause or one thing, because it's not one, it's a whole lot of things. And I think it's been a sort of a general degradation, I guess, of care for our neighbours. And I think that some of that is because we've become so busy, we've become so focused on, you know, keeping up with the Joneses, some of it's social media, some of it, I mean, there's a whole lot of reasons why that might have happened.
There was a longitudinal research by the University of Otago and found that youth offending dropped by 10% mm-hmm. amongst young people who moved into permanent social housing.
Yep.
I mean, what ways would secure affordable housing help to stabilize family life, especially for children and young people?
Well, it's that thing we were just talking about, right? As soon as you're in a stable place, and the research is in, you know, all around the world, the housing first model works, where you put somebody in a house and then you wrap the appropriate services around them, whatever those services might be. Young people are no different to that. That allows, if somebody has secure housing, it allows them to become involved in the community. It allows them to create friends at the local park. It allows them to join into sports or other cultural events. It allows them to go to school and come home. It's such a cornerstone to humans living that it is significantly undermining when it's not there.
How many more units of low-cost affordable housing do we need in New Zealand if we're to deal with the homelessness?
Lots. Lots. As I said, we stopped building to abundance. In Dunedin, you know, the numbers have been estimated at somewhere between 300 and 500. We don't know what that looks like. We don't know the numbers. And we also don't know the impact it's having on other things too. So, for example, we know that some of our businesses sometimes struggle to get people to come and work or study here because there's nowhere for them to live that's affordable or appropriate. So, you know, it's impacting us across the board not having good rentals. And Dunedin's rental market is a little quirky, primarily because we have a very large student population, and so a lot of our rentals are sort of around the student area. Our rental ecosystem is a little quirky in Dunedin, which makes it challenging as well.
Well, one thing I noticed in the 20 years ago was that all the houses I saw being built, they looked very expensive.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the building was going for people who could afford expensive,
mm-hmm.
not just well, because often they weren't well built. You had leaky houses, but that looked good, that looked mm-hmm. looked expensive, and they had, you know, a good quarter acre or more.
Yep.
And looked like you could sell them quite well too. But that also meant that you had fewer houses being built that were affordable on the private sector.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's interesting, isn't it? Because if you listen to some experts in the housing sort of market at the moment, and I'm not talking about real estate agents, I'm talking about, you know, analysts. They talk about things like at the moment you can buy or build something either small or large, but that stuff in the middle, that sort of regular affordable housing, is actually quite hard to get. And our builders who are building, you know, they build generally for profit. They're businessmen, which is absolutely fine. But we're not building those sort of what you and I would probably call average houses. We're not building those, you know, 100, 150 square metre houses that will suit a family. We're building either huge houses, you know, big four bedrooms on a great big lot, or we're building townhouses and, you know, increasing the intensification. Both of those are absolutely needed and are great. We need those, but we also need some of those other ones as well. And the more we build some of those more affordable family homes using current legislation, the more we get better quality of housing as well, because we know that we have a housing quality issue in Dunedin because of the age of our houses. We've got insulation issues, you know, and we have...
Well, it's a cold place to live.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, of course, the price of keeping your house warm has gotten much harder.
Yeah.
Of course, that's also something that came in the 90s.
Yeah. Yeah, it's when we went to that free market thing, right?
Exactly.
Mm.
You know, should the ability to be homed, to not be homeless, should that depend on your income?
No. I mean, your income should not denote whether you are whether you are entitled to a home or not.
Well, that's the basic question, isn't it?
Yeah, that is the basic question, and I think that's the question for New Zealand as a whole. I mean, we've got about, I want to say, 3-4% of our housing in New Zealand is social housing. You know, there's parts of Europe where the amount of social housing is sort of sitting at 20-30%. And that makes a significant difference to the ability for somebody to get into a home. There are also examples worldwide where we're seeing, so there's an example in Australia called Nightingale. They build apartment-style houses on transport routes, but they actually aim their whole customer ethos is for, you know, the single mum who works one job. And so they make things really affordable. We have a little bit of an issue here in Dunedin that we don't have the scale to warrant some of that, but we do need to actually look at how can we be a bit creative about bringing things that are, you know, affordable for people to live in.
Well, so we've got two issues here. We've got the issue of Dunedin homelessness, mm-hmm. and the issues of homelessness in New Zealand or Aotearoa.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is that if you wait for a government, including the present government, to get serious about providing homes for people with Kangiora, I mean, they've just cut back considerably on the houses they're building.
Yeah,
that's their solve. That's the way to solve the homeless problem, just build fewer homes.
Yeah. Yeah. They have cut back, and it's a bit unfortunate because one of the projects that they cut in Dunedin was a significant apartment build in the central city, which would have gone a long way to help us out in this situation. Yeah, I think we have to come up with some local solutions. And to be honest, I don't know what they are, but we have to come up with some local solutions, and we have to be able to be creative, because this you know, ramping up with one colour government and then ramping down with another colour government and then ramping up and ramping down, that doesn't do anybody any good. What we need to do is we need to find some sustainable long-term options for the city here, by the people of the city here. And there are things that we can do. You know, we can look at, you know, are the people who are willing to take their investments out of their, you know, however they've got them banked in stocks and bonds, and put them into impact investments where they still get a return, but instead of banking on stocks and bonds, you're banking in houses. You know, there are opportunities, but I think more and more we have to start thinking about how do we as a city be creative and create some solutions for ourselves that are not reliant on governments of whichever colour.
What happened to the $20 million that the previous council had budgeted to build more affordable houses?
So currently council has about 940 houses. We have rebuilt a number. So there were some that were no longer fit for purpose, and they have been pulled down and rebuilt, and we have just signed up to get another four built. So we are continuing to build as a council. We are now the largest council, the owner of the largest portfolio owned by a council in the city. That came out wrong, but you know what I mean.
Are you worried that the government might make things difficult for city councils who want to build and provide council housing?
Yeah, personally, I am. I worry that, you know, we could continue on building. We have as I said, we had a couple of hundred on our wait list. So yeah, I am worried about that. But the Dunedin City Council has been a provider of homes for older people since I believe, the 40s. So I don't see us stopping.
Do you think people are willing to pay higher rates if they can help getting rid of homelessness?
We last went out to ask. We went out on consultation, I think it was in, don't quote me on this, it was either 2022 or 2023, to ask the public if they wanted the council to continue to provide housing for older folk, and it came back with a resounding yes. So I believe there is a mandate there for us to continue to do what we are doing. The numbers that Kāinga Ora have in Dunedin is sort of around, Dunedin Mosgiel is sort of around the 1400 to 1500 number. And, you know, as I said before, council has 940. So we are a big player of accommodation in this city.
Well, I'll play some music now and then.
Sure.
That was Eric Vogel and Dreamer, a dream of a world without war and without hunger. And we're dreaming about a world without homelessness with Jill Brown, who's the principal housing advisor for Dunedin City Council. And you can podcast this by going to oar.org.ed and then going to podcast and going to Community of Chaos. Well, Jill, what would be the next thing you'd like to have happen?
Jill's utopia?
Yeah.
Jill's utopia is that we combine services in Dunedin, that we create outreach systems where we can actually go out and find people where they're at and get them the assistance that they need to live, you know, positive lives, that we create affordable housing that is truly affordable for people, so people can be warm and safe and dry. It's a relatively simple dream, but it's also very expensive because obviously it's going to take money to build homes. It's been proven around the world that shelters aren't the answer, that they're temporary. We need to actually follow the Housing First model and get people into homes.
Is it likely that we'll be able to provide affordable housing if the main purpose for housing market is making a profit and the fact is the housing market seems to be the main driver of the economy. Is this either good for people in need of homes or is it good for the economy itself?
I think there's room for both. I think there is room for groups to come in and create affordable spaces that remain truly affordable. Again, I cite groups like Nightingale in Australia. At the moment, the property market is a determiner of the economy. So, you know, I think we have to acknowledge that. Does it fit with my philosophy? Probably not. But, you know, that is what it is at the moment.
Will our economy ever improve? It remains that if we don't get a government that has the courage to change direction.
That's a really difficult question. I mean, all the economists who I follow believe that we need to look at productions and actually become a more productive economy rather than just putting it into property. But, you know, people are making lots of, you know, there are certain people making lots of money out of property. So although it's not highly productive, but I think there is the ability for us to work. There's the ability for us to have some housing or to carve out a space within housing, within the ecosystem of housing that allows us to look after those who perhaps are in a difficult position.
Don't you think that providing housing is as much an essential service as providing water and electricity? Of course, we don't consider electricity an essential service anymore, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, I mean, like
sewage and water, they're considered essential. Hmm. Well, it seems to me that housing should be considered essential.
Yeah, I mean, I personally think that it's essential. And if you look at, you know, Maslow's hierarchy of needs, it's shelter's the second one after food and water.
And I think if you ask people in New Dunedin, they would agree with you.
Yeah, especially on cold days.
But if you ask the people that have the levers of power, apparently they don't believe that.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's philosophical differences about how people put importance on others, right?
Yeah, I think your philosophy is often nudged by your own personal interests.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And as I said at the beginning, I'm a person who's always sort of fought for the underdog. That's been my mantra. That's what my parents instilled in me, is to look after the underdog, to look after the person who perhaps hasn't had the leg up. I was very blessed as a young person. You know, wouldn't it be great if everybody had the same upbringing or an upbringing that was as filled with love and respect and kindness and education as mine was?
How do you get a conversation going across, at least across Dunedin and Barnes?
I think the conversation's already happening. So, you know, the work that I've been doing for the last couple of years has been getting everybody in the room. And whilst that doesn't sound like a big job, it's like invite them to a meeting, they'll show up. That's not always the case. So we've got a number of ways that we are working together now, which we didn't have a couple of years ago. And there's a couple of groups that have who are also in this space that link up some of the strengths of Dunedin. So if you think of the Otago Housing Alliance as an example, it's linking, you know, our providers to the university. So we're starting to get this sort of joined up approach in the city, as a city, to do things for ourselves, because we tend to be a little bit ignored. We're no longer the fourth largest centre, you know, and things quite often don't come south of Christchurch. So, you know, we're beginning to go, well, we have to do this for ourselves. So we're looking at how we can do that. And it starts with getting everybody in the room.
So tell us about the Housing Alliance.
So the Housing Alliance is a group that has come together that has a whole range of providers and social sector, NGOs, charities, agencies, and basically they work in the space of housing, almost housing advocacy, but they want to take it a little bit further than that. They want to identify, you know, How do we join groups together to get really positive outcomes for the city? How do we, as I say, link up some of that research? How do we get some of those things that might be working in other spaces adapted down here? So there's quite a bit of work going on in that space. And again, this is all part of that bringing everybody together so that we are actually all connected as a city, which hasn't been the case in the past.
Do you think this will be an election issue in the local bodies?
I know that the OHA have sent out questionnaires to all of the candidates asking questions about housing, and that they plan to publish them. It should be.
Have there been studies about where we need to provide new houses, new builds in Dunedin? I mean, that's probably important. I mean, you've got the issue of transportation, you've got the issue of agricultural, horticultural land.
Yep. So the council at the last change of the district plan, it was called the 2GP, it actually made some significant changes to intensification within the centre of the city, and that has allowed for, that would allow for intensification. We've seen a little bit of it happen in Mosgiel along the main street, where there's been, you know, townhouses or smaller houses being built, generally with accessibility in mind, which is great. But that has happened in the Dunedin space as well. So there is the ability, and there is plenty of scope for people to build that. That's why we were so upset about the Kāinga Ora prop, and I know that the people at KO were upset, were disappointed too, that the apartment block wasn't being built. But, you know, it's still there. They still own the land, and we still might get it across the line. Who knows?
Kāinga Ora still owns the land?
Kāinga Ora still owns the land. So the land that I'm talking about is one in the central of the city. They've had houses on it that were less than ideal. They were very poor, very poor quality. They were built in the 70s. So they've owned the land for a long time. And they have got a project up to resource consent stage to build an apartment block. So it's currently on hold. But we're hopeful.
That's an interesting question, really, about quality of houses and builds, because I have a feeling that the houses that were built in the 40s and 50s were actually better than some of the houses that were built in the 70s and 80s.
Yeah, and that's what we saw in those houses. So those houses were, you know, built without eaves. They had internal guttering. They were built into the side of a hill. They were not pleasant houses. So, you know, they were a house of its time, unfortunately. But I agree with you. Some of those early, you know, the early state houses, they're amazing.
I live in one. I mean, I own one.
They're amazing.
And
beautiful floors. And
it was actually, I think it was a style in the 70s and 80s to build houses without eaves.
You know,
it's maybe if you're in a desert, that would be fine.
And internal gutters, it doesn't make sense in a place like Dunedin.
So would it be better if the city council owned that land?
Oh, you're getting into a very difficult conversation. No, I don't think so. I think that Kāinga Ora has identified that it's land that they will hang on to. It's a pretty much a wait and see. There's some work going on to see if we can push it along. But in the meantime, I know that the local regional director has been pushing it with the powers that be.
It's hard to see it happening is when they're cutting the number of houses being built across the country.
But we can take faith or take heart from the fact that they're not planning to sell it. So there is, you know, land all over the country that's being sold.
Well, that's how come there isn't more pushback against that? I guess people don't realize it's, if you're not people realize if houses aren't being built, but they don't, they're not aware that houses, that property that was meant for housing is actually being sold.
Yeah. The cynic in me would say that if you live next door to a kāinga or a piece of land that's being sold, that you might be, you know, that you would, the NIMBYism would kick in and go, yay, which would is a very sad indictment on how I feel about the reactions that some of the NIMBYs have had on some developments. But on the other side, if they're selling the land and it gets built on, it's more houses into the whole ecosystem. So it's got to be a bonus, right?
Oh, depends. I mean, if you're building a house, it's going to cost $500,000. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, if it's an expensive house, or if it's a house where there should have been perhaps three or four houses, you know, I mean, we're not talking about people building houses for our homeless folk, unfortunately.
And it's always going to be, you're always likely to make more money if you're a private developer by building expensive houses.
Yeah, I think we have to be mindful too that our private developers and across the country, but I can only speak for the ones that I've met here, you know, they are people who are making, you know, doing a business. You know, they are business folks, so it's got to make sense. They will, you know, that's their job.
So you have to build them yourself, or you have to make it possible for people that are building affordable houses to make a profit from it.
Well, there's ways that you can do it. So there are groups in the country that are, for example, developers, but they also hold charity status. So there are actually opportunities for buildings to be built without profit, without ultimate profit in mind. We don't have them operating here, but they are operating in the country. So it's about how do we get those services into Dunedin. We don't want to stand on the toes of the people who are building for profit, because that's filling a need as well. How can we get developers who aren't building for a profit?
How's it happening in other parts of New Zealand?
So there's the example that I can give you is one called Kāinga Maha. They are a developer based in Christchurch, and they've done a huge development out at Brighton, which has sold affordable housing, affordable rentals, the whole nine yards. So it's a quite a different style of model than anything that we have seen across New Zealand at the moment.
Can you tell us about that model?
Well, the model bases, so and you know, you have to understand I'm not an expert in this particular one, but I know in Brighton in New Brighton and Christchurch, they wanted to regenerate the area. And so Kāinga Maha have been developing that space with a range of houses available. So there's been houses that have been built and sold for profit, and that profit has offset some of the costs of houses that are perhaps at a lower or affordable rate to be sold. And then there's some long-term rentals as well. Build to rent is a growing area in New Zealand. There are a number of places that are doing build to rent. You've noticed that probably Simplicity is the latest one. They're investing with the Queenstown Lakes Community Housing Trust. They've identified early this week, late last week, that there was going to be 600 affordable rental homes being built. So there are things happening in that more affordable space to increase the supply. So, yeah, I don't think we should be completely negative.
Oh. The group in Christchurch, is it a public or is it a cooperative? Or
It's a fully-fledged charity.
Okay. Mm. So how did it get started?
I honestly couldn't answer that, but
could we do something like that in New Zealand and Dunedin?
We are actively working with them to see what we can do. And this is about getting everybody in the room, right? So there are groups in Dunedin that own land but can't afford to develop it. There's groups in Dunedin that want affordable rentals for their whānau who are perhaps coming out of hospital or whatever. So, you know, where, this is where those group opportunities come up.
Well, there was a group called Aberford that was mostly elderly people. Can you tell us about that?
Abbeyfield?
Yeah.
Yep, we have one Abbeyfield house in Dunedin. Abbeyfield is a worldwide group, and they specifically are it's a bit like a housemate type situation for older people. And we have one Abbeyfield house in Dunedin that has 9 residents, and I believe that it's just being extended to 12. They're all over New Zealand and the world. And basically it is on the premise that you move in, you're a bit like a flatmate, you have your own room and your own bathroom, but you share food, and the food is cooked by somebody who comes in and does the cooking and cleaning. And that cooperation, that community that is created by those residents increases the longevity of somebody's life by delaying their going into an old people's home or a residential facility by a number of years. It's a lovely model, and the house here is amazing.
Any chances of more of those being built?
Absolutely. They build generally as a nationwide group. They build a house generally every year, whatever that looks like. It's my belief, but I would have to check this. But it's my belief that Dunedin has definitely put its hand up for a second house.
Is there a group in Dunedin who's really working to try to connect all the ways we can build houses for people who need houses?
Yeah, I think that's where the two groups that come to mind. So I have a group specifically around working with our homeless whānau, and you know, how do we work with that? And then if we look at the OHA, the Otago Housing Alliance, they've got that sort of wider group. So yeah, we are definitely working in this space, and I'm part of OHA as well.
If you want to support the Housing Alliance, how do you do that?
There's a website, the Otago Housing Alliance, but some of you may know it's affiliated, or it runs alongside the Cozy Homes Trust. And so there's a website online.
Tell us about how Cozy Homes Trust, how is that working?
So Cozy Homes Trust, it takes the grant that is given by ECA to increase insulation and to do things like put the polythene under your homes and put in heat pumps. And Cozy Homes acts as a link between the providers and ECA, and then has the ability in most cases to top up some of that stuff through having got fantastic funding from places like the Community Trust.
Is one of the reasons we have quite a few houses that have mold and aren't great to live in because the student population will put up with it. And we have a large student population. And people will not so much build, but have minimal housing and get quite a hefty rent from them. But they aren't necessarily up to standards for people to live in.
Yeah, I don't think it's just. The houses are in Dunedin are generally, or the houses in New Zealand. There's a gentleman at work who's come from the US, and he says that we build bus shelters here, as opposed to houses, because of the standards of insulation are quite low. But I think it's also part of our own culture. I think it's, you know, put on another jersey. There's actually a piece of research saying put on another jersey, you wuss, which talks about how it's part of our expectation as New Zealanders that we live in cold houses, and it's just part of that make do, she'll be right type culture.
For the very
culture.
Young and very old, that's not a good policy.
Absolutely, it's not okay.
And it probably causes our Is it a health expense that people end up in the hospital?
Absolutely. And you know, we all know that New Zealand has a high rate of, you know, things like asthma and respiratory issues. So, yeah, I mean, there's definitely correlations between that. But I think it is part of our, you know, make do, she'll be right sort of thing.
Well, seems to me that we need to have a more positive attitude than that.
Well, I'd like to think that we have a positive attitude. I'd like to think that it would be pretty depressing if I came to work and everything was negative. We are making headway, right? We are making headway. The fact that people are in the room together, the fact that we have got support generally from the community, the fact that we are seeing, you know, even in these very, very tough times, we're seeing donations to places like the Night Shelter and so on still happening. I got contacted yesterday by one of the local schools, and the principal said that one of their has emailed and said that one of their classes or some of their classes are collecting toiletries and blankets. And so, you know, there's little pockets of gorgeousness out there, but yeah, it's pretty tough.
Well, thanks a lot for coming on and talking to us, and let's hope that we can have a vision for housing as a right, not as a way of moving our economy, which doesn't do much good for the economy, probably actually harms the economy, and puts housing in a position where we just don't build enough affordable housing.
Mm. So thank you for having me, and if anybody wants to make contact with me, they're more than welcome.
Thanks a lot.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.